From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And of course, it's always good to have an old friend do the show. And I love my old friend, Mark Forster, who's gone from big budget films such as Quantum of Solace to the more intimate films, films such as The Kite Runner, Monsters Ball, some of my favorite works he's done, some of the smaller films. His new film, Christopher Robin, straddles those two areas a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it straddles the areas. And it's, you know, I made a film many years ago after Monsters Ball called Finding Neverland, and I've always been looking since then for sort of a film about magic realism. And I never found something that really touched my heart. And suddenly when I came across Winnie the Pooh, I thought this is the right one.
Did you grow up reading Winnie the Pooh? Or?
Yeah, my mom gave me the first book, and you know, this funny story behind it. I was on a plane with my daughter, and she was watching Winnie the Pooh on an iPad, a cartoon, and she turned to me and said, "Can you finally make a movie I can watch?" I said, "None of your movies, they're all too dark. I can't watch them."
She can't say stay.
So I said, "Why don't we make that as a joke?" So 3 years later, here we are.
Wow. Because I remember you were telling me about this. You were really excited about it because, first of all, it gave you a chance to work with Ewan McGregor again, which I knew meant a lot to you. But it's funny because it feels to me almost like an old school Howard Hawks film. In some ways, it reminds me of Bringing a Baby. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it gives Ewan a chance to play comedy, which he's so good at and he so rarely gets to do anymore.
Very, very true. And, you know, funny enough, you mentioned Howard Hawks and Bring Up Baby. It's one of my favorite films. I mean, Catherine Hepburn's performance is absolutely brilliant. And it just, you know, I felt like somehow also it was a time in my life and I felt the world is becoming darker and darker. You feel like doing something lighter and something like Winnie the Pooh that feels like a warm blanket around you is just makes you happier because ultimately as a director, you know, you're dealing with the actors and the material every day very intensely and it's like it becomes part of your life for a year and a half, all the time you work on a movie, and it affects you on a very cerebral, emotional level.
It's funny you mention your daughter because so many of your films deal with children and these kind of catastrophic things that can happen to children. And that's kind of the premise of this movie. Christopher Robin grows up and loses his childhood and loses access to that part of him that's probably the best part of himself.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess one of the things I was thinking about, though, that seems to apply to so many of these films that you've done, I guess we've never really talked about this before, is so many of your protagonists have a kind of a tunnel vision. They can only see what's directly in front of them, and they have to be sort of aroused from that. I mean, we could go to your first film. Basically, almost every film you've done, a character has had this moment, almost a reawakening or rebirth. And I guess I wonder where that comes from for you.
It's maybe, you know, growing up in Switzerland, you have a sort of a tunnel vision. And I always had like, myself in my life, you know, I felt like if I need to get something done, if I have to manifest the vision I have, I just have to focus on that vision and almost force it into being. And I felt when, you know, especially with movies, you always like sort of seem to push them up a hill you know, bring them into reality. But at the same time, I learned the older I got, or the older I'm getting, is just to have a more peripheral vision, just be more open and just let things come to you. You don't have to, if it's almost, I don't want to say in a cliche way, when it's meant to be, but partly it's like you can't just, like in a tunnel vision, live your life like that because you miss out on a lot of things.
And that's so key to so many of these movies you've done because these characters, and we can go back to Finding Neverland too, they have to develop peripheral vision. It's this thing that they almost grow out of in some weird ways, like an ability to see anything other than what's in front of them. And so often too, these are characters, and you can do this to some extent with World War Z, who focus on a single thing. And because they've lost touch of everything else around them, they have to be pulled back into family.
Exactly. It's ultimately all pulled back into family. And that's what Christopher Robin is about, too, is ultimately Ewan has lost his touch with his wife and his daughter and his family. And you know, finding, you know, the inner child within you, but also being in touch with the people you love. And because ultimately, you know, at the, like if you look at your span of your life, life is really about the people you enjoy being around and the people you love, and not essentially about only your work.
Yeah, well, it should be. But also there are, again, so often there are traumas that force people to move away from these things. And for Christopher Robin, it's World War One, and that really, in a lot of ways, cost the world its innocence. You know, so you basically have tied an apocalyptic event in that way you do in World War Z, or in real terms in The Kite Runner, how these things separate people from their most innocent selves.
Exactly. The story takes place in 1949, just post World War II. But in a sense that he, you know, there's certain things where men went through war, and ultimately his wife gives birth while he's at war, and he meets his child for the first time when he returns from war, and that's already sort of that moment when he sees his daughter for the first time is already sort of this. A slight disconnect already, which then only gets through time, that doesn't heal completely until ultimately Pooh shows up.
Yeah, and in some ways his daughter is acting almost like an adult in the way her father is. He, by not being there for her early childhood, he's kind of deprived her of her childhood too. I mean, the movie sort of gets in this thing that I really associate with, which is the idea of balancing two tones at once. Mm. Which is the melodramatic and the comedic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting that you picked up also, you know, because I love those screwball comedies. And that tonally, to get that right, was really hard in regard to music, color, acting. And Ewan is literally, his performance, I think, is masterful, because he goes back and forth between the absurdity and the comedic tone and the tone that you really believe him. And most of the movie, he's acting towards air, because obviously, Winnie the Pooh is digitally, you know, reanimated in post-production, so he's acting to an eyeline stick. to pull out that kind of performance and that kind of focus and tunnel vision, focusing on that eyeline stick, it was pretty remarkable watching him do that.
It's the treatment. We're talking about concentration with our old friend Mark Forster, whose new film is Christopher Robin. But in some ways, I find these movies so often me thinking about conceptually making movies, because you're doing something, you're creating reality out of an illusion. If you try to explain this to people who don't really get what you're doing, it can sound kind of silly or crazy to them. And so often these protagonists almost feel like they're, in some way, you is trying to sort of skirt this line between reality and illusion, but trying to convince others. And it becomes this almost mission for these people. I mean, thinking about Brad in World War Z, or Johnny in Finding Neverland, or even it happens so often, people trying to, or Will Ferrell, trying to convince other people that what's going on is real, even though it doesn't quite make sense as they're saying it.
Yeah, I think all these stories I'm attracted to and these stories I'm telling, it usually comes back to me because when I grew up, I grew up in Switzerland in the mountains, and my parents didn't have a television, they didn't have anything, so I always had to entertain myself. I never consumed entertainment, so I always had to go out in the forest and play myself, so I always had my imaginary friends and sort of interacted with and created these worlds around me, and then ultimately I'd said to my parents, I want to be a storyteller. Once I told them a storyteller, they thought, oh, this is a silly idea. And I ultimately always had to convince everybody about the reality I wanted to create or the life I wanted to live. And so subconsciously, that's the stories I was drawn to, about protagonists who are basically trying to convince others of the reality they live in.
Yeah, because I felt that these movies, in some way, every single one of them feels autobiographical. Somebody's trying to explain something that, if whether it's real or something out of fantasy, it's something that sounds fantastical as they're saying it. Mm. And that idea of, for you, explain to your parents this thing you want to do, which in some way probably didn't make sense to them, becomes this through line in all the movies.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the through lines that connects a lot of my work. And I think though in regard to Chris Robin, the comic relief was very sort of helped me a lot, because I think ultimately when you take this too serious, it doesn't serve me or I think anyone else. But if you look at it through a lens that's through physical and emotional comedy and these character comedy situations, I think you can laugh about it and you can laugh about yourself, which I think is very important, to look back and laugh about yourself.
But it's a tough thing to pull off, because you could have moved this movie 10 degrees to the left, it becomes tragic. I mean, it could very well have done that. And there are parts where there it is tragic. Like I was saying, we were talking about the stuff in the war, and you make that incredibly felt. I mean, that's not just something that somebody talks about, or you play it out in real terms, where you get that sense of fear and also this kind of sense of watching, again, the innocence of the world die. And that happens. It happens in Monsters Ball. It happens so many times. The idea of innocence having to die in your movies and be reborn somewhere else.
Yes, I feel like we all go through this journey, that ultimately we all will lose our innocence sooner or later. I believe life tests us too many times. That none of us, however strong it is, for some people more tragic than for others, but we all at one point lose our innocence. And I think then ultimately it's about finding that innocence again. And I always thought there's one metaphor that always stuck in my life. When you think about as an infant, you're in your mother's womb and you're being fed, it's warm, and you have unconditional love. And I think like once we get born, we are in this, like we literally get like in, we come into the world and it's light. It's, we have no food. We have less love. It's like we're screaming, and it's like we didn't want to leave that lovely place. And I think our entire life we're trying to find our way back to that womb where we have unconditional love, food, warmth, and it feels, and you're protected. It's safe.
And that idea too of I guess I would say too, the part of your job as a director is to keep that innocence alive in you and to find a way to continually extend that, create that world so vividly that innocence is rekindled in audiences, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for me, it was especially doing something like Christopher Robin is about, you know, there's not just the nostalgia about the character, but is sort of to bring that innocent back, because I'm a big believer. And always optimistic. I would be one of these people if the boat sinks. I said, no, I'm sure we're not sinking. There's a way out of here. We're not going to drown. But I'm just always optimistic, and I believe that to keep hope alive and to keep belief that there is a sort of innocence, and there is sort of this. Almost like this, because when I was like as a kid playing these imaginary games or imaginary worlds I created for myself, I always, they were an escape. And I think making these movies are an escape, telling these stories are an escape, and it's an escapism. But always for me, it's a belief that it's everything is going to be okay. And that's ultimately here also with the ending, when because you want them to all find each other, you want him to find back to his family, you want them all find a place that it's not, you know, there's still work to be done, but you know there's a path.
My guest, who certainly just gave a whole new subtext to his film World War Z, is Mark Forster, whose new film is director is Christopher Robin. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking about watches. You don't want to hear about that. But we're also talking about innocence with my guest, director Christopher Robin, Mark Forster. It's The Treatment. And one of the things I find really kind of interesting is when you're doing period films, we can feel your love of movies. I mean, to some extent, both Johnny Depp and Ewan McGregor are kind of doing Cary Grant in these movies. I mean, they really kind of knock about. They're wearing vests. I mean, there's that kind of old school movie romance is really evident in these period films you do, isn't it?
Yeah, I do. You know, obviously, but as a director, I do love movies, and I'm you know, I've been loving them since I was a kid. You know, one of the other characters you and I always were talking about was Jimmy Stewart as well.
Well, this could be Harvey.
Exactly. That was one of the references we always spoke about as Harvey, which was a film for, we both loved. So we always had this obviously it was Harvey, the imaginary bunny.
Well, there's a scene in a boardroom near the end of the film. I don't want to give too much away, but that could be Harvey.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's the point where, because again, at some point in these movies, even for Heath Ledger at some point in Monsters Ball, the protagonist's sanity is questioned by the people around him. That happens in every single film that you've done. Somebody's asked, are you crazy?
Yes, and it's to be honest, like, I mean, again, talking about autobiographically, you know, I was, when I was a kid, I was diagnosed as dyslexic, I was diagnosed with ADD, and my parents, because I grew up in Switzerland, I was never, you know, I had a very healthy childhood, I was never medicated, but I had to go and see a shrink, and then the shrink looks at me and said, oh, why don't you draw a tree? So you draw a tree and said, oh, why doesn't the tree have any roots? What's wrong with you? why doesn't it? So the shrink looks at you very, 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 very closely, and so I get analyzed as a kid, and partly always questions by my world around: is this kid sane? Is he okay? And so it was always for me a question: what is sanity? What is? I think ultimately, if you escape in your fantasy, if you respect everybody else and don't hurt anybody else and live a respectful life, you can be as strange as you want to be, because as long as it makes you happy and you're not hurting anybody else.
It's interesting, just because seeing you, and I'm fascinated by the fact that so often in your career you've taken on these kind of iconic texts, be it Zombies or James Bond or the work of A.A. Milne or Alice in Wonderland, and this idea of these things that exist, but it's important to you to bring your take to these things. And I wonder what it is, because that could be a really daunting thing to do, to take on these things that people feel they own. Like, people feel like they own Winnie the Pooh. Everybody has their own relationship with those characters. And I wonder if that was a little unnerving for you in that situation.
Yeah, I think in this situation, it was actually... It was less unnerving than in some situations in the past. Like, for instance, with The Kite Runner, was a book that was read by 10 million copies, were sold worldwide, and I was sitting in planes and people telling me, suddenly recognizing me and saying, you better not mess up this book. And I was like, it's like frightened me, like people were like saying, oh, you better not mess this up. But in a sense of Pooh somehow, because Pooh was never done as a live action character. Pooh only existed as a cartoon. And my intention was to create an origin story, go back to the early Shepherd drawings, go back to where the starting point, create those animals, those stuffed animals, as they've been used, well hugged, that you feel like, and going back to one of the things asked Jim Cummings to do the voice of Pooh, which ultimately, because he did the voice since, you know, late 80s till now, and he gives you sort of almost this as you're meeting an old friend. Obviously, his performance is very different than in the cartoon version of the film, because we adjusted the performance, but at the same time, it was less daunting because there was never a live action film about Pooh, and I said it's sort of this origin story, and it's introducing Pooh to a whole new generation of kids and a generation that isn't familiar with Pooh.
Well, I thought it interesting, too, and I'm glad you have brought it up, because I want to talk about it, is that those characters all exist as kind of archetypes. Mm. And but there is, in Pooh, and you sort of mentioned when you brought up being there is this almost unearthly calm to him. Mm. I mean, and of course, in the cartoons, things are ramped up a little bit, and the actors have to be a bit more antic in their vocalization. But here, I mean, he is... Even he's actually speaking in riddles at some point. I mean, it's almost like these Zen cones that he's speaking in. But finding that vocalization that's about calm and confidence in the most childlike way, what was your conversation with Jim Cummings like about finding the tone for Pooh to work?
I was always a big fan of The Tao of Pooh, the book, and just the Poohism in general.
And the book's actually full with lines that could be spoken by Pooh in the movie.
Exactly. And Jim and I said to Jim, look, because at the beginning Jim was so used to working on the cartoons, and I said, look, this is sort of how I imagined it. When we started doing the recording session, I always brought him in, showed him the daily, showed him cut scenes, showed him footage, sort of that he understands the tone of the movie and the way I would approach it. And that Pooh has this sort of Buddha... you know, kind of little of wisdom but childlike logic he lives in, and it's a but it's very funny and same to absurd, but it also has some deep meaning at the same time, which A.A. Milne created all these quotes. They're so funny, but in the same time still carry a certain wisdom that one can't deny.
It's funny too, because the movie I found is almost literally grounded. I mean, the earth and the dirt is really important. And you talk about the root of the tree that you didn't draw, but there is a kind of rootedness that these characters all have, because they're so close to the earth, and they're almost always in contact with that with the forest. And once they're outside of it, and we do get to see them outside of it, that kind of confidence you talk about almost disappears. It becomes, in some ways, almost like a comic take on a horror movie. But the idea of groundedness, literal groundedness, is important to you in this film, isn't it?
Absolutely. The literal ground was very important, and feel that the film is grounded in reality. But it's funny that you said that sort of a comic take on a horror movie. It is, you know, of them walking through a door into a new world, and that new world being, you know, for them, it's like a little scary because they don't know what to expect.
And also the way the color grading changes in the real world.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing is quite as vivid
as it
is in the forest. And I guess what's really kind of fun about the movie is we can see, and I guess we've never talked about this before either. It's funny, I think of you as a friend, but this bone deep love of movies and the thing that movies do, and inserting yourself in a genre so you can offer us your take on that, is really integral to the way this film works. Because we've got to fall in love with the narrative, but also to fall in love with the form you're using for it, which is live action and a take on a character that people know.
Yeah, it's also, you know, it's interesting because when we go back in the form of the narrative, live action is sort of like Roger Rabbit was one of the first ones applying that and going throughout history. And
some of the section of Anchors Away where Gene Kelly's dancing with Jerry the Mouse. I mean,
exactly.
It happened piecemeal, but until Roger Rabbit, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it hadn't been the text of a movie, the entire text.
Exactly. And then it sort of became more, like in recent history, obviously more and more people sort of got used to it, and obviously we had a speaking teddy bear in Ted, which was a very different take. And when you see, for instance, like when we looked at that animation, for instance, also about sculpting the bear, I looked at Ted, who is very vivid. His face moves, he moves around. The bear moves very differently, and his performance very differently. And then with Pooh, who is very zen, and his face almost doesn't move. It's very still, and he's just like moving at a very slow pace, which was another thing. Interesting enough, when you watch the movie, you say always, okay, how fast can he walk that he doesn't feel too slow? Because you don't want the audience to obviously feel that the movie is slow because Pooh is moving slow.
We're talking about making a bear real with my guest, Mark Forster, whose new film is Christopher Robin. It's interesting, too, because I was thinking about, again, both Depp in Finding Neverland and McGregor here. They're both wearing tweeds and these kinds of suits that are almost, like our friend Tom Brown, they're a little too tight. They feel like they're kind of trapped in these adult clothes that they're wearing too. So there's that aspect of the how constricting adulthood is.
It's amazing that you bring that up, because you see in the film there are always these moments as a boy when he leaves his childhood, he puts on the school uniform in front of the mirror. Then he goes to military, puts his military
that smock that just is nothing but freedom.
Exactly. And then goes to war, he has to put on the military uniform. And then he goes to work and he has to put on the suit. So he's always in a uniform, always in a straitjacket, until, you know, basically he goes back to a forest where he's trying to get stuck in the straitjacket as he's trying to re-enter into the woods.
Well, I was just thinking about that, even with the costumes that Will Ferrell wears. I mean, those are the idea of so often for you of suits is this thing that you're trapped in. It's basically this uniform that doesn't allow you any freedom at all. And I think that's really interesting, your take on adulthood in terms of costuming.
Yeah, it's you know, I was sent to boarding school, and then in Switzerland you have the military and so on. So I feel uniforms in general often can be very constrained and can can feel like a straitjacket. So that's why I could have probably never been able to work in an office. a 9-to-5 job wearing a suit would have been very constrained to me.
I was thinking too with Christopher Robin's boss, he can also be Fred McMurray from The Apartment.
Yes. Yeah, Mark Gatiss. Well, wonderful actor.
He is, but I mean, when he goes to work, I mean, I've felt that sort of Billy Wilder aspect of the film too. I mean, that the efficiency expert, a job that only exists in movies. and just that kind of fear that exists in there, that made me really... It really did bring The Apartment to mind for me.
Yes, I love that apartment. It's a great Billy Wilder movie. Yeah, I think when we discussed early on what kind of job Chris Robin should have, and we ultimately landed on an efficiency manager. He's trying to has to cut down time. That ultimately time management and cost management is like, I think an efficiency manager was a good metaphor for him. More of a metaphor than a job.
But
yeah, you have an efficiency manager at NPR.
Oh yes, no, wouldn't work on this show. But that too, because you were talking about Chaplin, I could find myself thinking about Harold Lloyd and the way you use the clocks and the way Harold Lloyd uses them in Safety Last. I mean, the idea of the clock being this really kind of terrifying thing, and it could actually finish you off, and also the pressure of time in the real world versus the blue skies and the sense of taking things a moment at a time in the 100-acre forest. I mean, that you worked really hard to make those kinds of textural differences play too, didn't you?
Yeah, but there was a painter called Lowry I was very inspired by for all the cityscape in London. He was a painter at the time, and he wrote, he doesn't use a lot of color in his paintings, but with the color he does use, it gets very poignant. But and all the people, it's very gray, and they're all like sort of this slim stick shift kind of how he paints people. And he was sort of a reference for me when we designed the sort of the London part of the film, because also at that time, London had a lot of fog, was a lot of coal. So
after the war.
Exactly, it was really dirty. So to keep that feeling alive, that it's not a pristine city, and there's not much greenery there or color.
But it's kind of, it's not that dissimilar to the London of Finding Neverland, where it feels like it's kind of a gray, oppressive place, and there's no place to go to get a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. No, especially at that time, because of the pollution was really bad.
Well, tell me, has your daughter seen this yet?
No, she's not. She will see it in London at the premiere there. So she'll be the biggest critic. So we see.
You have to come back and tell us what she had to say about the movie. Well, I guess we're out of time. Mark, I can't thank you enough for doing this and making time to do this. Thank you.
Always so great to see you, Elvis. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm glad you enjoyed the movie.
Me too. My guest, whose new film is Christopher Robin, is Mark Forrest. I'm sorry, try this again. My guest, whose film is Christopher Robin, is Mark Forster. See, I know his name. A recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DiLaglia. The show is mixed by Kat York. It's edited by Blake Byte, who's associate producer. I'm going to go and buy myself a nice tight suit. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.